Today, in an address from the White House, President Trump spoke about the two mass shootings this past weekend in Dayton, Ohio, and El Paso, Texas.
The shooter in El Paso posted a manifesto online consumed by racist hate. In one voice, our nation must condemn racism, bigotry, and white supremacy.
Police say the El Paso shooter was motivated by fear of a Hispanic invasion. And at his rallies, President Trump has spoken of an invasion at the southern border. Let's bring in Peniel Joseph, an historian and founding director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy at the University of Texas in Austin. Peniel, welcome back to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we had intended to have you on to talk about race in politics and the legacy of George Wallace, the pro-segregation Alabama governor and presidential candidate from the civil rights era, and the connections that many were making to President Trump. And we're going to get to that. But first, on the news of the day and the clip that we just heard of President Trump there, what did you make of what the president said?
Well, I think two things. I think that it's important to say, and I'm glad that the president or his advisors pushed him to say that this was an act of domestic terrorism and that racial hatred and white supremacy have no place in American society. But at the same time, the ironic contrast is that much of the president's own rhetoric, both during the 2016 election, but also in the last two plus years of his administration, has really bolstered the very forces he is now forced to publicly denounce in the wake of these horrific, tragic mass shootings this past weekend.
Well, and in fact, to that point, let's listen here to President Trump back in May at a rally in Panama City Beach, Florida, talking about migrants illegally crossing the border when a supporter yells out at the rally, shoot them.
But how do you stop these people? You can't. There's no... That's only in the panhandle you can get away with that statement. Only in the panhandle.
In other rallies, the president has spoken of an invasion at the southern border. The suspect in the El Paso shooting reportedly wrote online that his views on race predated Trump. But how responsible is the president for a climate of hatred towards immigrants?
Well, I think President Trump is largely responsible for amplifying that pre-existing climate, Jeremy. I think one of the things we have to understand is that when we think about who we are as Americans at our core, white supremacy or white nationalism absolutely has a place in American history. But what the Civil War does, when we think about 1861 to 1865, we have to think about the Civil War as a battle for a new nation. Not only the end of racial slavery, which slavery is the key reason why that war is fought, mm-hmm. but how do we redefine American citizenship? Who has claims on that citizenship? And since the Civil War and the 100 years after the Civil War, you saw women get the right to vote. You saw the Great Society with voting rights. You saw increased immigration. You saw a much more expansive vision of who we are as Americans. So when we think about that rally where people are saying, shoot them, and the president says you can only get away with that in the panhandle.
And everybody's laughing.
We have this conflict where there really are these two Americas. There's this pre-Civil War America where women don't have the right to vote. African Americans are ensconced in racial slavery, where people who are poor don't have labor rights, don't have unions. And then there's this post-Civil War United States that brings us, by the 20th century, the New Deal, the greatest generation when we think about the Second World War, the civil rights movement, the feminist movement, a movement for LGBTQ, a movement for immigrant rights, just this multicultural, multiracial America that Dr. King talked about at the March on Washington. And those are that competing vision of America is what we find ourselves locked in. So Trump's rhetoric is not new, but it is new in terms of the modern American society that a president would bolster that kind of divisive rhetoric. And it's really destructive to the nation state, as we've seen. When the president aligns himself with white nationalists and white supremacists, he creates a culture of violence. He didn't originate this culture, but he has amplified it through his rhetoric.
Okay, well, let's draw the comparison with George Wallace, which many people have done over the last couple of weeks. Here's Wallace back in 1963 in his first inaugural address as governor of Alabama.
And I say segregation now, segregation tomorrow, and segregation forever.
Did George Wallace say those things because he believed them or because it was smart political strategy?
Well, it's a combination because George Wallace initially is much more moderate on racial segregation. He loses the race for governorship and he says that he's never going to be out and he uses a slur by an opponent again. So he becomes sort of the most eloquent and strident racial segregationist of the time period. But also he's a populist. So his rhetoric is very similar to Trump's in the sense of he talks about white working class Americans who are being given the short shrift even during the Great Society. He says this is largely happening because the federal government is too focused on African Americans and civil rights and racial integration and making your kids go to school with black kids. And, you know, your daughter is going to have to marry one of them. And he really amplifies both this resentment that working class whites have against Washington, D.C. and this sort of perceived northern elites. And he amplifies racial division. So when we think about George Wallace, he won five states that Trump later wins. You know, it's sort of Georgia, Arkansas, Louisiana, you know, Alabama, Mississippi. And he wins one electoral vote in North Carolina. Those six states Trump won in 2016. So there is this historic division when we think about not just regional division between North and South, but in terms of the white working class and what president or administration has really done something for them, especially since FDR's New Deal.
And by the way, in 1968, as a presidential candidate, Wallace went on Meet the Press with Edwin Newman and denied that he was a racist. Let's listen.
We are not fighting anybody because of race. We are talking about philosophy and principles of government.
Governor, there's a recent article in the Saturday Evening Post on you, and it quotes you as saying, and these are the words, "Let them call me a racist. A whole heap of folks in this country feel the same as I do. Race is what's going to win this thing for me." Were you accurate in quoting?
No, sir. I didn't read the Saturday Evening Post article. I don't read articles in these periodicals much that have written so many distorted and slanted things about me. I might have said along the line that many people agree with me, but I don't believe that anybody's going to be elected president because of the race issue.
Okay, so that's very interesting to listen to that. I must say that last week when I was at this Trump rally, there was a group of about a dozen African Americans in an almost entirely white crowd of nearly 20,000 at the rally wearing T-shirts that said Trump and Republicans are not racist, and they had the hashtag Blacks for Trump. He actually called them out during the rally. He says he's done more for African Americans than any other president, lows in unemployment, criminal justice reform. What do you make of that, of the argument that he makes that he's not racist and, in fact, he's done so much for the African-American community in this country?
Well, yeah, I think that's an absurd argument, but it really shows you that by the impact of the heroic period of the Civil Rights Movement, because by the passage of the Civil Rights Act in 1964 and the Voting Rights Act in 1965, the March on Washington and the embrace of civil rights by both the Kennedy and the Lyndon Johnson administration, it was no longer acceptable in mainstream discourse for a number of reasons. We think about Cold War liberalism and the ties we were trying to create, alliances with African nation states and third world nation states, to be overtly racist, to sort of proudly claim. So even Wallace goes from in 63 saying he's a proud segregationist, by 68 saying, well, no, he's only for the rights of the white working class.
And he eventually renounced his segregationist views later on in his career.
Absolutely. So Trump is doing the same thing. So we live in this world with, racism with no racists, right? So what you see is it's about a policy. It's about racial segregation. It's really about outcomes is how we measure race. And it's also about the dehumanization of people who are non-white in this country. We dehumanize immigrants through rhetoric and policy where we put them in cages. We dehumanize blacks through mass incarceration and racial profiling and poverty and segregation. So we always have to look, who are we dehumanizing? Who are we saying that these children's lives matter? These communities matter. These folks matter. And when it comes to racism, we can tell by those outcomes. So I'm not surprised that both Wallace and Trump would definitely maintain that they weren't racist. And so did Richard Nixon and President Ronald Reagan. And now we have the tape of President Reagan calling African diplomats monkeys.
Right.
So that's probably our smoking gun for many people. But for those of us who study the Reagan administration, we'd say that even without calling black people monkeys or Africans monkeys, he was promoting racially bigoted policies because of the impact that these policies had on predominantly African-American communities.
That is historian Peniel Joseph, who is founding director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy at the University of Texas, Austin. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Jeremy.